You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, and I am here with maybe my favorite band of all time. And I realize on a podcast you're supposed to let people talk, and I'm going to let them talk, but I got to ramble first, and here's why. You know, when you're hanging out with your friends or whatever, when you're 14 or 15, you kind of think of like dream bands, you know. Maybe it's like Iggy Pop with Johnny Thunders, or maybe it's like Joe Jack Talcum with Joey Ramone, or maybe it's like Billy Idol with Mick Ronson, or maybe KRS-One with June Joe, or maybe George Clinton with Lee Scratch Perry. And there was always one in my mind that I dare not speak because it was too inconceivable. And to even say it would be, I don't know, blasphemous, or people would just think I was insane. But I used to think to myself, what if the Melvins did a recording with Amoebics or Nausea? And my dream came true. My dream came true because the Melvins have got a brand new album. It's called Tarantula Heart. It is friggin' rad as hell. It's Buzz. It's Dale. It's Steve of Red Cross, and it's Roy of Nausea and Amoebics and Stone Sour and Ministry and Youthquake and a whole bunch of other bands. And the record is extremely rad. It's out now via Ipecac. We're going to hit you with a song, and then I'm finally going to let the guys talk. This is maybe my second favorite track off Tarantula Heart, the new Melvins album. It's called She's Got Weird Arms. Thank you for coming on the podcast, Buzz. I've interviewed you a bunch of times, And I always appreciate that you're so generous with your time. I feel like I annoy you, so I'm sorry about that. So thank you for indulging me and letting me talk to one of the greatest musicians of all time. So thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, you are probably the most annoying person I've ever met. I don't, but I want to make one correction, though.
Sure.
There's also a second guitar player on this record called, his name's Gary Chester. And he added a lot, you know, so.
Gary Chester of Ed Hall and also of We Are the Asteroid, and I should have mentioned him. We Are the Asteroid also have an amazing single that actually they were selling on the Melvins tour maybe two or three tours ago, where it's We Are the Asteroid with Danny of Surfport and Amy of Amo and the Sniffers, and that track is super rad as well. So,
stay looking out for that. I've known him for 30 plus years, and I always really admired his playing, and it's great to be able to do something like this with him.
Yeah, and we'll actually talk about the new record and about how people were involved in it. It's a super interesting record. But Roy, thank you for coming on the podcast. I actually interviewed you once when A Sonic Mask came out briefly, so you probably don't remember that episode. But thanks again for coming on. I'm super psyched to have you on, especially with Buzz.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man.
I'm not going to make Buzz or Roy reiterate the idea behind the new record, but the idea behind the new record is the following. Buzz, correct me if I'm wrong. Buzz and Steve would riff while Roy and Dale would do drum parts, just kind of off-the-cuff riff. Then Buzz deleted the guitar and bass with Steve. Then he took those drum tracks and then had Gary Chester, Steve, and Buzz did new guitar parts over the drum parts, and Buzz also rearranged some of the drum parts. So he created an album from, I guess, disparate parts to make a cohesive release with music that wasn't recorded together with the artists interacting with each other. Is that correct, Buzz?
That's mostly correct, but it wasn't the idea at the beginning. I mean, I didn't come up with that idea until after I was living with the jams that we had done. And we had did a tour a couple years ago, about 2 years ago, with Ministry. And Roy would graciously come out every night and play a couple of songs with us. And so midway through the tour or so, I was like, oh, we got to do some recording together. That'd be great. And then when we got home, we have a studio in LA, and we go, come on over. He brought a big synthesizer and some drums, and we just did some jamming. I had no idea what was going to happen. That's about right, right, Roy?
Yeah, that's completely off the cuff. We had no idea what we were doing. We just did it. Just put our gear together. You hit record. We jammed. That's it. Like a few times, like 7-8 times, and we have 7 or 8 songs or whatever. And something like that. Yeah.
And then I just took those jams, and I had kind of basic riffs, sort of, that I wanted to use. And then the first one that I did was Allergic to Food, and I found a section in that jam, I don't know, 4.5 minutes or 5 minutes long, where the drums just locked up in a way that I thought was really cool. And I didn't chop it into time. I left the parts exactly as it was. Then I found the section that where it worked, counted it all off to where I could figure out how to fit stuff into it, and then wrote brand new stuff to it. But when I was about halfway through it, I realized I might be able to do this for like a whole record or almost a whole record. This is actually kind of cool. So then when I sent, I can't remember, Roy, you came to the studio and we played it for you, or I sent it to you and you're like, what the hell is this?
I think you played it for me like after the fact. And I was like, how the hell did you do this? Because I remember, I specifically remember certain drum passages and phrases that Dale and I were doing, and then I would hear this music over that. I'm like, wow, that's like, I can't believe you just took that, just that raw drum track, and wrote all this music over it. And the parts worked out. Some of the parts go like 6 times, some of it goes 8 times, so 12, but it works. It just somehow worked. I think that's pretty amazing. Like, I've never made a record like that ever. You know, usually you do like some pre-pro, or you write all your stuff before you walk in, and you're all in the same room together and you're jamming, like, but this wasn't the case this time. So it was pretty, pretty cool experience for me, man. It was awesome.
Yeah. And I kind of stumbled into it. I certainly didn't think of that, but what we ended up getting was music that the accents that the drummers are doing aren't exactly where they would play them if we had rehearsed it.
Right.
So we get something new. It's a new sounding thing. And I knew that I had to tell people this because I didn't know that people would notice that. And but I noticed it. I was like, when I'm listening to it now, I'm listening to the guitar parts and hearing how the drums are playing it. And I go, they would never play it like that. They just never would. It wouldn't feel natural. So we got something brand new, but now I think it's the only time, when I think about it now, it's the only time I'm ever going to be able to do it, because if we tried to do it again, everyone would know. Everyone would be suspicious of it. You know what I mean? You guys weren't thinking of that, because I wasn't thinking that.
No, we were just off the cuff of, like, you know, just kind of staring each other down and just playing, and whatever came out, you know, there's no click track or anything. So we're just all off our own clock. I really loved how organic and raw this session was. It was great. I haven't done anything like that ever.
Yeah, me neither. And so it was really cool. We've done so many albums. It's nice to come up with something that I hadn't done before. And I'm not afraid of that sort of thing. I played it for some people, and they were like, well, what if you then now took this and then rehearsed it? And then I think that would ruin it. I think that would ruin the idea of what this is. Now, if we go to play these songs live, that's exactly what we're going to have to do. And it's going to change it. There's no way around it. It has to change it. But
it'll still be chaotic. I think it'll still be chaotic, though. I mean, even a song like Allergic to Food will still have that, you know, on edge, you know, off the rails, chaos it naturally has, because that's the song. What we did was just make the blueprints. So we have the blueprints now to make that happen if we wanted to. So,
yeah. But if we play it live, it will be like learning a cover song.
Yeah.
Because we never rehearsed this stuff. We've never, ever played any of this stuff together, because it's not what we originally did.
Yeah.
that's the weird part. But as long as you're willing to be okay with things being a little strange, which I like anyway, you can come up with stuff like that as long as you get out of your own way. Let it happen. Things can happen, you know?
The weirder, the better.
The weirder, the better. And Roy also brought over a synth, and that's what opens the whole album on Pain Equals Funny, is him playing. And then what me and Tosh did is, I don't know, you played probably, I don't know, 15 minutes or 20 minutes, something like that. We recorded it.
He just hit record, and I just improvised. Like, I brought an ARP 2600 synthesizer over. It's like a 50-year-old synthesizer. To people out there who don't know what an ARP 2600 is, you can hear it on the Frankenstein by Edgar Winter. You can hear it all over Depeche Mode. You can hear it all over Kraftwerk and early Kraftwerk, like 70s. It's a really unique synthesizer. It's a 3-oscillator synthesizer. It's just a nasty sounding synth. And yeah, I brought that over and had a couple of echo pedals. I had like an RE-201 Roland Space Echo, and I just went to town. And Toshi and Buzz just took what they wanted from it and just made something out of it. Yeah.
We added it. We'd go back and find pieces of it and added it all over lots of the songs. We would go, oh, this would be a good section to put this part in. And that we did chop up. But the beginning is not chopped up. Like, the very beginning, the first thing you hear is that synth. And that's one section as an intro to that song, which is really cool. Which, I mean, I like that kind of thing. I mean, albums are, to me, they're not live. And so I don't approach them like they're live. I approach them like they're a whole different kind of thing. And so I never think, how will this translate live? Because I never worry about that. I don't think people, maybe there's some people that are so stupid, they think when they're listening to a record that they're seeing a live show. I personally don't.
I personally like a surprise when the band's a hair different live. I mean, what you guys, you sound nothing like your records. When you guys play live, it's a whole other animal, and it's cooler because it's just so in your bass and so off the rails. You know what I mean? I love that.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. My one of my favorite bands is Who. Before I ever knew what they were, I saw on the liner notes of some of their records that they used ARP synthesizer. You know, which I didn't even know at the time what any of that stuff was. That would have been in the early 70s.
Yeah, he used it. That was Pete Townsend. He used the 2500 right before the 2600. That's the big guy. That's the three-panel synthesizer. There's pictures of him with it. He still has it.
I'll bet. Yeah. But they did a record. They're one of my favorite bands. They did this live record, Live at Leeds, that I think is arguably one of the greatest live albums ever. And none of those songs sound like they do on the record. And so I was like, okay, that's fine to do. I learned that lesson really early on. You don't have to make your, you don't have to make your songs sound like the record. And I think Arsenal, arguably, they that those could be better versions than the recorded versions.
I think they are.
Yeah, really good. They're just unbelievable. But the whole experience of this record, I think, is not something I'm ever going to be able to do again, because it was so fresh and new. And I discovered it as we moved along. And people like Roy and Gary and Dale and Steven, they're open-minded to letting me do what I want. They're not, they didn't question it. They just listened to the end result and were like, oh, that's cool. They're like, nobody said, let me go in and redo this part, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, just, that's good. You know, I'm not afraid along those lines. And once it's all done, and oh, you know, one thing, Roy, I don't know if I told you this. Toshi told me, he goes, mixing it, he goes, I had to mix this thing. It was this gigantic mess. And he goes, he goes, all I did was hit delete on tracks.
Wow.
until it popped out. Oh, there it is. You know, because I just kept deleting
stuff. He definitely had his work cut out for him, man. Like, I can't believe he mixed two drum kits and all those layers and crazy sounds you came up with. There's one particular track. I think it's She's Got Weird Arms, where the drums, it's the only track where I think the drums, Dale and I are on, one's more to the right, one's more to the left on the speaker. Because before they're all together, I think those two are like, you can really hear us separated on that. I think I'm right about that.
Yeah.
It's pretty noticeable. Like, Toshi is just like amazing. I mean, the fact that he just held that down and really, really like nailed that mix. It's amazing to me, like what he's achieved with that, all those tracks. It's a lot of work.
He does a good job. Go ahead.
If the listeners don't know, Toshi Kasai is, I guess, the sound engineer or producer for you, for the Melvins studio that you guys. Is he sound engineer, producer, or both, or what title does he use?
Recording engineer.
Recording engineer.
I would say recording engineer / producer, but he says he gets to do lots of stuff with us that no other band would let him do. You know, so you know, he goes, I learn a lot of stuff, but I never get to use it with other bands.
Yeah, he's incredible.
There was one interview with Toshi. It might have been the Vinyl Guide podcast, where the host said to Toshi, so what do you learn from working with the Melvins? And his answer was nothing I can use elsewhere, or something like that, which I thought was hilarious. I will say, not to denigrate the other Melvins albums, but Tarantula Heart is fantastic. It's one of the best ones. And I don't mean to throw shade on the other ones, but it is fantastic. And I love, you know, Buzz was talking about how the drums were recorded in unusual fashion. It gives the whole release kind of this menacing, not quite right feeling, almost like a horror movie, the entire thing. And I love how it's got that cosmic meanness, which is like my favorite thing about the Melvins. But Buzz kind of talked about how, and actually, Roy, I got a bunch of stuff to ask you too. But Buzz talked, and actually, if you get the vinyl version, I don't know if it's, it comes with this 7-inch by 7-inch storybook, which is really cool. Mackie Osborne, the Melvins in-house artist, did the art for it. It's kind of got this story, and it does kind of have like a supernatural element, and kind of, I guess, beyond the physical concepts within the art and the lyrics. Buzz did an interview a little while ago where he mentioned that Mackie's his wife. He said that Mackie and I share a lot of things: artistic vision, work ethic, and he also said spiritually we align. Buzz, I'm curious as to your spiritual, I guess, angle. Is there more to this world than the physical? Because going off these books, you know, there's a lot of supernatural at work with the Grim Reaper, with ghosts and whatnot. Where do you sit, I guess, spiritually right now, and how did that play into the album, if at all?
I don't know if it played in the album, but I really like goth stuff anyway, and I like scary stories and cute violence a great deal. Cute violence always works. My wife is really good at that kind of stuff, and all I said was I wanted to have a storybook, and I wanted the record cover to be gothic looking, and that was it. That's all the direction I gave her. All the rest of that stuff she just came up with, and she'd show it to me, and I'd go, "That looks great." It's always twisted, weird, but that's her vision as well. Both of us are really into you know, Charles Adams and Edward Gorey and all those kinds of things, a great deal. And as far as spirituality goes, you know, I don't know, but one thing I'm sure is that I really think it's impossible for non-living matter to just have became living matter. So I think there's something more to it than that. Well, beyond that, well, I don't really know
what it is. Well put it. And one thing I want to add, then I'm going to ask Roy a question, is I kind of mentioned how the album has this menacing feeling, and I feel the Grim Reaper on the cover really symbolizes that, in that he's like, he's chasing after this little girl in the book, and he's like hanging in the background, or she, the Grim Reaper. And so I like how it really gives that menacing quality a visual element from the album. But changing gears, Roy, you joined Nausea in the mid-80s, and that's right around when the Melvins, you know, Melvins formed in like 82 or 83, and the Melvins, along with maybe Flipper, along with Popo Pies, along with Pill, were kind of one of the first punk bands to slow down and get heavy. Were you aware of the Melvins in the mid-80s when you joined Nausea, or did you learn about them a little bit later on, or what's your relationship with the Melvins?
It's actually funny. I talked to Buzz about this a while ago when we first met up a couple years ago. I found the Melvins through our sound engineer when I was with Nausea. Our Nausea sound engineer in Europe, his name is Adam Schwartz. He was front of house for a lot of bands, you know, around that time, but he was our front of house in, it was like 1990. He had Melvins. I think it was Bullhead. And that was the first thing I heard. But I'm like, who is this? He's like, it's this band called the Melvins. You need to listen to them. And I listened to that record for like a month straight. That's all I listened to was that. And that's what got me into Melvins.
You know, Buzz, I know you talk a lot. Well, you have talked a lot about maybe the LA punk scene and maybe even like Ramones and that kind of a thing. Roy, if you ask me, is responsible for the greatest reunion record of all time, Amoebic Sonic Mass, which I think is a mind-blowingly great record. Thank you. So Buzz, were you familiar with, I mean, I realize Roy joined Amoebics in the 2000s, not in the 80s, but were you a fan of like Amoebics, kind of maybe the first slow UK punk band? Or maybe any of the Crass stuff or Anti-Sect. Were you a fan of that? Or did you really come aware of Roy, I guess, more through Ministry and that side of things?
Well, I knew about Crass right when they first started. But when I heard the Amoebics, it was probably about 85, maybe 84, 85. And that record, I was like, oh my God, what the hell is this? Because I always liked Crass, but I liked the Amoebics a lot more. I thought that the first time I heard it, I was at where had driven down. We're playing in San Francisco at some squat, and somebody was blasting it in their like little room, and in this squat. And I went over and knocked on the door, and I was like, "What the fuck is this? I've never heard it before." And that's how I became aware of them. He showed me the record cover and I was like, oh my God, I got to find this one for sure. It wasn't that easy to find that record at the time.
Do you remember which record it was?
It was
probably Arise, right?
Yeah, it was Arise.
Yeah.
Whatever the newest one around 85 would have been. 84, you know? Yeah. And it had more, what I liked about it was it had more of a metal edge than any of the Crass stuff did. And I was like, oh man, that's good. That's really good. Finally, you know, like, but I mean, I always liked the Crass stuff, but the Amoebic stuff spoke to me a little bit more musically, you know, felt a little more comfortable to me automatically, but I never saw them. Never saw Crass either. I don't know if Crass ever played where I was at, you know, anywhere I was at. So I have no idea what their touring things were. But, you know, I was aware of all kinds of punk rock bands from I probably got into punk rock around 77, 78, maybe. And that was all just from looking at pictures of them in magazines and mail ordering the records. You know, prior to that, I was really into Bowie and Aerosmith and, you know, all those bands, Ted Nugent. And that just led me to more and more stuff. I didn't know anybody that was telling me about any of that stuff. And then I found out, you know, from there, I just went from there, you know, just kind of just moved into hardcore, and I liked all that stuff, but learning about all this stuff on my own, I was never made aware that hardcore punk rock and Led Zeppelin weren't cool together. So to me, it was all good. I never was like, oh, I hate that hippie shit. I never did that. To me, it was either good music or it was bad music. And hardcore to me just sounded like more heavy metal, which I thought was really cool. And one thing I really liked about them was that they were fucking pissed off. And that's, you know, at least these guys are fucking pissed off. I'll take the pissed off band over, you know, over usually. And I was like, I like that energy, and I like the heavy metal. The fact that hardcore punk and heavy metal share this thing where they're both rebels. And I like the rebellious nature of all of it. True rebels. I like that. And they're a lot more similar than they are different to me, you know? So anyway.
Well said. I guess, is there a chance of Roy joining Melvins live at some date in the future? I know you guys did it on the Ministry tour, but since Roy is on this record, is there a chance of Roy maybe drumming with the Melvins, maybe one off or here or there in the future?
Anything's possible. I'm open-minded to anything happening at all. I mean, I think Roy is a really super great drummer, and I would love to work with him in any capacity.
Yeah, I'm into it, man. Anytime. I mean, yeah. If I'm around and the time is right, and yeah.
Yeah.
It'd be great.
I mean, I knew right away when he played songs with us. We did Honey Bucket and Hooch, and both of those are, especially Honey Hooch, is it's kind of a weird song. So the fact that he could play that shows me that he gets what we're doing, because it's not necessarily all 4/4 stuff, you know?
No. I've also been listening to that song for 30 some years too.
Yeah. But it's different than people drum wise, especially a song like Hooch. It's different than what people would think. You know, like the vocals, under the vocals, the drums are kick drum, you know? You know,
actually after playing, I remember after jamming it with you in the dressing room before actually going to play it, the way you broke it down to me, I understood it even more. I already understood it in a different way, but the way you and Dale broke it down to me, it's like, oh, now I get it. Now I really get the timing. It's like it's like listening to the beginning of Rock and Roll by Zeppelin. Nobody realizes it's off the time. It's on the and, and then on the one. It's the same thing. It's the same thing with the beginning of Hooch.
Yep.
In a weird way. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's. There's a saying, I can't remember where I heard it, but they say if you do something right, no one will notice that you've done anything at all, you know? And it's like, if you play some hard part like that right, it doesn't seem hard. You make it seem, until somebody breaks it down and goes, oh, wait, that is kind of complicated, you know? But like, not everybody could just sit down and play the opening for Rock and Roll. That's a fucking weird drum beat.
You know? I just think Johnny Be Good. Someone just say Johnny Be Good. That's the opening.
Yeah. But I know people would screw that up. You know,
it's easy to screw up because you when you hear that intro, you think that's the one. That's really the end.
Right. Yeah. Well, when we write stuff, I don't count music in the normal way, and so Dale will go. Dale and Steven will go, where do you hear the one? I go, it's here. And they go, well, that's not the one. I go, well, then don't tell me what it is. Just leave it. It's my one.
This is my one. You hang with your one.
You hang with your one. This is where it starts. That's my one. So they go, okay. So then they'll discuss it themselves and just let me have my one, you know?
That's funny.
Yeah.
Well, I'm the same way when I'm coming up with parts, drum parts or guitar parts, whatever, like, I don't count it out as I'm playing. Like I do that after the fact to figure it out. Okay, what did I just do? Okay, that's in 7. I didn't realize that. That's something I'm able to tell someone else that's gonna walk into the situation. You know what I mean? That's the only time I. Yeah.
Well, I, 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 I'm loving being a fly on the wall here with Roy and Buzz talking tech talk and
Oh, sorry, sorry. I didn't
how
go
the
off
no
on top
no
like
no no I'm loving to hear how the sausage is made to reference another Melvin's record. This is very cool. I guess I want to ask Roy maybe one more question and then maybe Buzz one more and then we'll play a nausea track and hit some news. Because I honestly I can hang out with you guys forever, but I don't want to hang out for 3 hours. You guys are like, oh my God, that guy won't let us go. Roy, so I guess last question for you. For this portion, you've recorded with many, many people, some maniacs, some pros, maybe maniacs, maybe more in the nausea camp, but you've also recorded with Soulfly, the two best Soulfly records, Soulfly 1 and 3. You've been in Stone Sour, you've been in Ministry. What's it like recording with Buzz and Dale and Steve and Gary? What's it like, or maybe you weren't all in the room at the same time, but what's it like working with them? How does that relate to the, I guess, other artists that you've worked with?
I mean, it's completely. I mean, every situation I've been in, every band that you just mentioned, it's all the situations are all different. You know, this is, like I said, by far the most off the cuff and different and improv situation I've ever been in to record with a band. Because, like I said, normally when I before I walk in a room or a studio to record with a band, we already have material. I just walked in and just blindly played with another drummer. It's, I mean, it was a great experience. I mean, I'd love to do that again and see what else happens. You know what I mean? I almost prefer those kind of moments because you make happy accidents, you know?
Well said. Buzz, last question about the new album, then we'll play a track and come back and do some news. Buzz, I feel, and feel free to say, I always feel this way, but I feel that you are extremely pleased with Tarantula Heart, and dare I say, giddy with how it turned out, and like I said, how it is. And I mean, I love all the Melvin's albums, but I really, really love this one. Buzz, are you particularly thrilled and tickled over this album? I feel like you are.
Well, I knew I liked it. I knew that there was plenty about it that I was excited about. I was really excited about how it came about, but I didn't know what other people were going to think, but I didn't really worry about it. I was like, well, I like it. I think it's cool. I really like the concept. I really like everybody that's on it. I really like how it all ended up mixed, how it all sounds. And I was ready to just, let then you release it out into the world and you let people have their opinions or whatever it is, and you walk away from it. But what was surprising to me was that how many people really liked it. Because I thought maybe it would be a little weird for people, but it turns out it people seem to really dig it. I mean, there's always going to be somebody who hates what you do, but like I gave it to the Ipecac guys, who we've been doing records for 25 years with them, and they were like, "We think this might be our favorite record of your guys that we've done." I was like, I never would have guessed that.
Wow.
I know. I was like, okay, I mean, I don't mind. I mean, I knew I liked it, but usually I can listen to a record and I live with it up until about the time it comes out. And by then I've moved on, And so by the time people hear it, like we it's been living in our worlds, mine and Roy's, for 2 years, almost 2 years, so
Yeah,
it's not
that's.
exactly brand new to us, I mean, we did those sessions, what was that, in May? It'll be
Yeah.
2 years in May, something like that. So, by the time most bands, when they have a record come out, it's not new to them. It's very new to the people that are hearing it for the first time, but to the band, some of the songs could be years old, by the time the public hears it. So I'm really happy with it. I'm really glad people like it. And I don't know that I'll ever be able to do a record like that again, but I was really happy that it turned out the way that it did. At least none of us are stupid enough to stand in its way,
Well,
That's
there you
important.
have it. Melvins are anything but stupid. I say they're probably the most clever band there is, or one of the most. So anyway, Tarantula Heart is out now via Ipecac Records. You can check it out on Bandcamp, and then after you do, you should definitely buy it because it is totally rad. We're gonna play a Nausea track. As Roy's mentioned, Nausea is kind of in the middle of a reissue campaign here and there. Some re-releases of classic Nausea stuff is coming out.
On Svart.
Let's hit. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Roy. I'm sorry.
It's coming out on Svart Records. Svart.
Well, the Svart, Svart Records, and let's listen to Cyber God, maybe the most well-known Nausea track and one of the best. It rocks, and it will inform our discussion when we come back.
Cyber God.
back and we're going to hit some news. I'm extremely excited to talk about this story because I think Buzz, in my opinion, is very different. And Buzz, I think you'll understand. Even if we disagree on this topic, I definitely think you're one of the absolute greatest and super clever. So don't take it personal if I disagree with you on this issue, although maybe we'll agree. A bunch of artists have signed a letter against predatory AI, including Robert Smith, Stevie Wonder, Nicki Minaj, the band Cake. Let's see, a couple other known people. The estate of Bob Marley, Billie Eilish, Don Was, producer of the Rolling Stones, Chuck D, and a whole bunch of other people. As part of the letter, they stated that they want AI developers to pledge that they will not develop or deploy AI music generation technology, content, or tools that undermine or replace the human artistry of songwriters and artists, or deny the artists fair compensation for their work. Later on, it says, make no mistake, we believe that when used responsibly, AI has enormous potential to advance human creativity and in a manner that enables the development and growth of new and exciting experiences for music fans everywhere. My personal opinion is I think AI is probably a bad thing and we should burn it at the stake. Now, I don't really feel like that. I feel like AI could very much maybe figure out how to cure a lot of diseases, maybe build bridges better, stuff like that. But instead of AI seemingly being used for that, it appears to be tracking me on social media and making pictures and making fake videos of, say, I don't know, Keith Richards saying things he didn't actually say, which to me is extremely threatening and wrought with a bad future. And so I think there needs to be a lot of, just like asbestos is regulated, I feel like AI really needs to be tied down or at least monitored. Now, of course, the other side of the equation is, okay, what if we tie it down in USA? They're not going to tie it down in Russia or China or India, you know? So I don't know, man. I'm very concerned about AI. I like that this letter kind of stands up. Will it actually do anything? I don't think so. But I was actually annoyed at that last sentence that I read that said, we feel as though AI is an enormous potential for creativity. I think that's wimpy. I think the artist should be saying, listen, we're the artists. The point of AI is to do work for us, not to do the fun things that humans get to do, like make art. And so you guys need to cut it out or we'll figure out a way to make you cut it out. So I think this letter comes off as pretty wimpy. But that being said, maybe it's because the artists really have no leverage. I mean, what are rock and rollers going to do against Google, against Apple, against these giant companies that we don't even know what the real name is? So I'm very interested in Buzz's opinion. But first, I'm going to throw it to Roy, because he is one of the guys behind the track Cyber God. Roy, what's your point on AI and AI and walking into the arts?
Well, I mean, I see with AI, I mean, I see that it could be a useful tool, like you said, but unfortunately, the way society is now, I think AI would be dangerous and it would just be used for bad things and it will just continue to evolve. Therefore, I'm sort of against it.
Are we doomed, Roy? Is it already too late?
Well, they made movies called Terminator, and there's a thing called Skynet. So, yeah, we're fucking dead.
Buzz, in other interviews, I think you've had somewhat of a more optimistic opinion, but I don't want to put words in your mouth either.
I mean, look, I'm friends with a guy who's in the Screenwriters Guild, right?
Mm-hmm.
They went on strike and they're freaking out about AI and being, he goes, the only thing is every one of these motherfuckers these writers are going to go home and use AI on their own secretly to do the work for them and then claim it's their own. He goes, you're never going to be able to stop that. There's no way you can stop that. That's because generally people are going to go the route of least resistance and they're lazy. And they're not going to just, oh, you know what? I'm not going to do this. So I can totally see people generating music on their own and then claiming that it's that it's theirs. You're not going to be able to stop that. And this is assuming all of these artists who signed this thing make good music in the first place. I mean, you know, there's so much crap out there that people, why are we worried about AI making crap? You know, that's assuming that all of it. It's like I heard somebody say, people are worried about driverless cars. She goes, frankly, I'm worried about cars that are being driven by humans far more than, you know. So, I mean, I don't really understand. They're saying one thing, but we'll just see exactly how much they actually go along with that. And you'll never know. You will never know what somebody used AI or whether they didn't or did. There's no way to know that. I mean, you're not going to get rid of it. What are you going to do? You know, and the other thing I see a lot of people saying stuff about, you know, AI takes money out of artists' hands and, you know, for art. It's like, okay, if you're listening to my stuff on streaming, why aren't you buying the physical product? Why not? I don't understand. Where do we stop this? You know, I mean, my wife is a graphic designer. When she started doing graphic design, she used X-Acto knives. Now she uses Photoshop. Should we go back and be upset about, you know, the people using X-Acto knives, those people that don't get the same business that they did before? I mean, where does this end? There's no way. Before there were cars, there were people who made buggy whips, you know, for horses. They're out of business now. I mean, this is nothing new. It's nothing new. You know, I personally am not afraid of the Terminator. I'm not, you know, I'm afraid of you killing me, not of a machine killing me.
The machines have been evolving for years, man. I mean, since the dawn of computer, there you go. I mean, who knows, 50s, 40s, is that when the first computers were starting to be developed, Buzz, around that time?
Yeah, like that, but I mean, you know, if you want a Terminator type of machine to walk through a room, then it has to figure out what's relevant and what isn't. Right. We do that automatically. They're True. Not going to be able to do that. They're just cameras. That's it. So how will this ever work? You know, it's like, if you're on LSD, it makes everything relevant. That's all it does. It doesn't do anything else. You can't just walk through a room because now every color of every single thing is relevant. So how is an AI machine going to decide what's relevant and what isn't? It's going to do a shitty job. I've heard AI music. It's fucking shit. It's crap.
People know that.
Yeah.
Huh? People know that. And people know that for sure.
Right. So, yeah. I mean, but there's lots of crap out there made by full-on human beings. So where do we draw the line? You know, if somebody is listening to my stuff on streaming instead of buying my physical product, should I be upset with them? You know, quite frankly, I'm happy they're listening to my music at all.
Well, Buzz, I think you might not be. I think you should be upset with them, because I definitely think artists. I do think there is a burden on the consumer to support the artist if they enjoy the artist. That being said, when you go to a Melvin show, be sure to check out the merch table, because the Melvins put a lot of hard work into making custom limited edition records on a antique printing press, and they kind of draw pictures on them, put stamps on them. So the Melvins are, I want to say, merch masters, but merch sounds wrong, because I would say they're art masters, and that they have the best merch table in the music industry, because you can get these hyper limited, very cool, handmade records. I actually have the artist proof of Melvin's 1983, which they just had at the merch table sitting right there for sale. So thank you, Buzz.
I love that stuff, but what I realized is the key to that kind of thing is not making very many of that stuff, because it's not going to be, not everybody's going to appreciate it, but the people that do really appreciate it. So that's the audience for it. I mean, I'm a collector. I collect all kinds of things. I get it. I understand that mentality. So that's our target. I'm not, you know, it could not be more hands-on, more do-it-yourself. It could not be. We're one of the most hands-on do-it-yourself bands that there's ever been. And if people want a human experience, AI is never going to be able to replace live shows, although there are plenty of bands out there who are not actually playing live. So it's true. You go. You know. So where do you draw the line? Where do you draw the line? I mean, I just go, look, I don't know what's going to happen. I have no idea what the future holds. I just try to be open-minded and realize that, you know, all I ever wanted to be was a musician in the first place. And the fact that I get to do this is way beyond anything I could have ever thought would ever happen to me when I first started. So I surpassed my initial expectations within the first year that I was in a band. So this is all way beyond anything. The fact that you are talking to me right now, and Roy is sitting here and we're talking about music that me and Roy make, that's absurd to me. That's just a crazy thing, considering where I started from, you know? I mean, so long ago. So anyway.
Well, speaking of crazy things and the Melvins on tour, at Punk News, we debuted the first track from J.D. Pincus's new album. The track is called Charmer. It's about not his pet snake, I think a snake he knew. The album is called Grow a Pair, and JD will be on tour opening for Buzz solo with Trevor Dunn, which is called King Dunn. And that's this summer. There's a whole bunch of tour dates, which I'm psyched for. Fun fact about the new JD album is about half the tracks are Butthole Surfer songs that the band didn't want to record because they didn't feel like getting together or who knows exactly what, but they were intended for Butthole Surfers, ended up being J.D. Pincus. Buzz, I'm assuming you dug this new track, Charmer. I sure dug it. It's got a real kind of slinky feel to it, and it's instrumental, and I really like it. Buzz, did you enjoy Charmer, and are you looking forward to touring with J.D. this summer?
Well, I've done a lot of work with Jeff in the past, and I was a big fan of Butthole Surfers probably since about 82 or 3 when I first saw him. And once again, the idea that I would be doing anything with somebody from that band is crazy to me. So I'm a big fan of Jeff's, big fan. And the tour that I'm going to do with Trevor, we do 45 shows in the US with Trevor's on stand-up bass and me on acoustic, and 25 in Europe. And JD's going to do all the U.S. shows, and we're working on getting him on the European ones right now. But I'm re-releasing my solo album, This Machine Kills Artists, as well as Gift of Sacrifice, together with, as a double album, with a flexi disc thrown in with a new song on it. So that's exciting. And I am a big fan of Trevor Dunn as well. I think Trevor is one of the most talented and funny people I've ever been around. And I cannot wait to go out and do this with him. So it's been a big year for me. I get to do this record. I got to do this record with these guys that were willing to let me do what I wanted on it, and very open-minded, and they're great players. And that's the other thing. I think Roy could probably go along with this. When you let people do their job, you get a much better product out of this. Just let people do their, don't you think?
Yes.
Don't give them too much direction. You'll ruin it, you know? I mean.
And that's what I loved about our record. It was just kind of like walk in and just play. I didn't even know it was going to be a record. We were just casually just getting together and jam. That was the beauty of that whole session.
Yeah. Yeah. Seeing how it worked. But I'm a firm believer in letting people play. Just let them do. I already know they're good. Now let them do their job, and everybody will be better off. I don't know everything. That you put me together with guys that are really good, it just makes me better. You know, I mean, that's just how it works. The best thing you can do in music is surround yourself with the best possible musicians. Miles Davis did that forever. You know, it's a smart play. Appreciate the artist, appreciate the people that are doing their, like my wife, I appreciate what she does. I let her do her job. Roy, Dale, Steven, I didn't go out there and tell you guys what to do. It's like, let's try this, you know, let's go. And it works. And it doesn't always work, but it mostly works if you just let it happen. I've been so surprised for so long about what guys that I have faith in are capable of doing. And I just hope I don't get to the point where I think I know everything, because I don't. One thing I know is that I will not be let down by people who are good. You just let it happen, you know? So anyway, Roy, I really appreciate the fact that you were willing to do this. And I have the utmost respect for your ability as a musician and your insight into what you're doing. The fact that you're willing to do it, you know?
Feeling is mutual.
So thank you so much. What was that?
To the feeling's mutual, man. Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Well, speaking of Buzz recording with talented musicians, and I just got a couple news stories we'll wrap up with. Blondie and Green Day and a bunch of other acts are now in the Congress's National Recording Archives. And the reason I bring up Blondie with the Melvins was because Clem Burke of Blondie, the drummer of Blondie, is on the Melvins album Everybody Loves Sausages. Also introduced was Gene Autry's Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, Rocket 88, which a lot of people say is the first rock song ever, Surrealistic Pillow by Jefferson Airplane, Ain't No Sunshine by Bill Withers, The Cars by The Cars, ABBA, Dougie Fresh, Slick Rick, and even Bobby McFerrin's Don't Worry, Be Happy. Yes, I realize I spelled parallel incorrectly on the headline here. Roy, do you agree with these picks? But also, if Nausea or Amoebics or Ministry were to be introduced into the National Archives, would you be excited? Yes, we're legitimized. Or yes. Would you be disgusted because now you are part of the mainstream?
I mean, to be acknowledged, why not? I mean, I have no problem with that.
How about you, Buzz? Would you like being introduced into the National Archives?
Well, you know, that's just not something I'm ever going to have to worry about, am I?
You don't know that. I mean, it could happen if they let. I mean, Dougie Fresh is not as big as like Jay-Z. You know what I mean? So like, it's possible. You know.
Well, anything's possible, but it's not something I spend a whole lot of time worrying about. It's like,
what do you think of their picks then? Like, do you agree with most of these picks, or would you have put in other acts like maybe the Fugs or whoever?
Most of those I don't know. I've never heard of. So I have no idea what they sound like. So whether it's a good pick or not, I have no idea. I know I like Blondie a great deal. Green Day, I remember when me and Dale, we were recording Stoner Witch and we heard an advanced copy of the Dookie album. And we said, nobody's going to buy this shit. They sold about 50 million copies. I would be the worst A&R guy in the world, you know? I mean, to me, you know, I was just like, well, this just sounds like the Descendants crossed with the Dickies. Who cares? You know, and there it is. Now it's National Archives. That shows you what I know. You know, I mean, you know, my picks for that kind of stuff would never be close to anything, you know. Throbbing Gristle, Birthday Party, you know.
Boy Mountain.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I don't think about, you know, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame type of stuff. I just don't. I mean, it's not part of my life.
To be acknowledged by something like that, it's cool, man. You know, but that's not why we got into, you know, playing music, is to be acknowledged and noticed by them. But if they not acknowledge you, great, awesome.
Oh, it's great. I just don't think it's going to happen. So I'm not. You know, if it happens, great. But I can't. I can't. Set myself up to be disappointed by stuff like that. All I can do is be, and I am very grateful to be in the situation that I'm in. And exactly. I don't want to look at it like, well, this should have happened to me or that should have happened to me. No. I am very, very, very fortunate. I get to, all I ever wanted to be was a musician, and I get to do that. And I don't ever want to lose sight on the fact that that's enough.
Yeah. You know,
the fact that I get to do it is enough. Recognition, all those kinds of things. Great. Yeah, if it happens, but it's already happened as far as I'm concerned. I've got to make a living for a long, long time by just being a musician. I am blessed, you know, and it's like, you know, the harder I work, the luckier I get, you know. How it goes, you know.
We're never going to stop. And we're always going to keep going. We're lifers, man.
It yes.
Buzz, one quick question. You talk about Throbbing Gristle a lot, but I'm just curious, is do you like Psychic TV? Because I think I like Psychic TV as much as Throbbing Gristle, to tell you the truth.
Different.
I like that stuff okay, but I like my favorite record that any of those guys ever did is a record called Heathen Earth, which is a live album. And that's the shit to me. I mean, that's what really drove the Throbbing Gristle hook straight up my ass, was that record. I'd never heard anything like that. And when I heard that, I was like, oh, my God. It's just like doors opening. It's like, oh, wow. Oh, okay, this is possible. I don't know. I don't know where that came from. I don't know what they were listening to or what they were into. You know, I mean, Psychic TV are fine. But throughout that, especially that record to me is just, I will never tire of it. And it's been a massive influence for, you know, decades, 30 plus years, you know, more so than people might think.
Of course, there's 20 jazz funk greats, which is great hits. That's a good one.
The record. The record. All the records are great, you know.
They all are. but that one
they all are. I mean, but that's the one. The Heathen Earth record is really the one. That's the one that makes me want to shut the lights off and put my head under the covers and just freak out, you know.
One quick question for Roy, then we'll wrap up with our final story. Roy, Joe Jack Talcum recorded some tracks, and it's sort of in a Tarantula Heart type thing. A guy named Chris Oliver reworked all the Joe Jack Talcum tracks into something new, which I thought was kind of cool. A little known fact about Roy is he lived in Allentown for a while, just kind of outside of Philadelphia. Roy, do you have any fun Dead Milkman stories? Because you were in Allentown in the mid-'80s to late-'80s.
That's funny you mentioned that, because one of the bands I was in at the time when I lived in Allentown, I was in a band with my brother, and it was an offshoot of Youthquake, a band called Word Made Flesh. We played with Dead Milkmen in Allentown, and it was like 1986 or 87 at Airport Music Hall. That was the only interaction I ever had with them. The only first and only time I ever seen them. They're nice guys.
Yeah, fair enough. Well said. I guess last news story, and then I'll let you guys go. Thank you for hanging out with me. I really appreciate it. Once again, the Melvins' new album, Tarantula Heart, is out now. It's awesome. Nausea's got some reissues coming up. So anyway, the big news story of last week was Kiss has sold everything, not just their publishing, not just their sound recordings, everything. The costumes, the stage show, any IP whatsoever associated with Kiss has been sold to a company called a Stockholm-based company called Pop House Entertainment. They are the same company that kind of did a digital ABBA show. And of course, Kiss is one of the biggest IP masters in the music industry. I mean, their IP probably spreads more farther than any other artist. I know Buzz has had a couple interactions with Gene and they were all positive. I don't put words in Gene's mouth. But the question is for both of you, Roy and Buzz. Roy, if someone came along and said, I'll give you $20 million for Nausea, everything, would you take it? And Buzz, if someone came along and said, I'll give you $100 million for anything Melvins, everything Melvins, and we can even do digital shows where Holo Buzz is on stage playing guitar, would you take it, Buzz?
No.
$100 million? $100 million. Sold.
I'll do it for $120 million.
Yeah, $120 million. I mean, $100 million. I mean, yeah. I mean, why not just say a billion? You know.
I'll do that. Yeah.
A billion. Yeah, I'll do it for a billion. Sure. I mean, I'm never surprised when people like the Kiss guys, all they ever said was, you know, we're making a lot of money, and that's never been a big secret of theirs. You know, I mean, I never fault people for making money. It doesn't bother me. I'm not
goddamn Kiss dolls in the 70s. That's what did it. That's what started
exactly.
It.
Exactly. I mean,
this guy over here bought all of them.
Right. I don't know how these companies think. I don't know how much they got. I mean, how much did they end up getting? You know, how much did Kiss get?
Who knows?
I have no idea, you know, but I don't know how they're going to make this money back.
I agree.
I mean, it's probably $300 million or something, you know, I mean, or more. I don't know what they're thinking. I mean, how much merchandise Kiss t-shirts can you sell? You know, I mean, I don't know. Is there a lot of money in Kiss publishing? Maybe. I have no idea. It seems like a lot of money. It seems like that's a once in a lifetime offer for them. They might as well take it, you know.
I mean, especially the 70s Kiss records, definitely. I mean,
yeah, I mean, there's lots of their stuff I like, and those guys could not have been nicer to us. So I don't have any bitch about them on a personal level, and there's plenty of their stuff that I like, and I guess, you know, good for them. Hopefully they know what they're doing.
As in many times in my life, I feel like a lot of people know something that I don't know, and that like Stevie Nicks is publishing alone. Sold for like $300 million. Bruce Springsteen's publishing alone sold for like $500 million. Publishing right now is actually worth less than it's ever been thanks to streaming services.
Well, that's
and
what
so
I
my
would say,
you know? My question is, so like do certain investors know that the streaming game is going to change wildly or something? Like, I just don't see Bruce Springsteen movie placements being worth that much in the next 30 years. But we'll see. We'll see. Anyways, let's wrap this one up. We're going to play maybe – definitely one of the best Melvin songs ever. Before we wrap it up, Roy and Buzz, anything else you want to mention? Anything you want the people to check out? Once again, the new Melvin's record's fantastic, Tarantula Heart. You can get it on vinyl. You can get it on CD. It's out now on Ipecac. It's got one sidelong track, which we're going to play in a couple of seconds, and it's awesome. And it's got another side that's got some really cool, varied songs. I absolutely, absolutely love it. And that's No BS. It's awesome. Every time the Melvins put something out, I'm excited. I'm ultra excited on this one. I love this one. I can't wait to see Buzz Live this summer with Trevor Dunn. And hopefully the Melvins will do a tour after that. And Roy is always on tour with many bands, so be sure to check Roy out. Roy is one of the best drummers there is. So Roy and Buzz, anything, and as I said before, Roy is the mastermind behind the best comeback album ever. Definitely check out Sonic Mass. Maybe it fell a little bit under the radar, but you can find it out there on the internet. It's great, so be sure to check that out. Buzz and Roy, anything else you want to wrap this on up with, or should we let the music do the talking?
Oh, okay. No, thanks so much. I've told him this, but I really want to thank Roy for his involvement, and especially the other guys as well, and it was a really fun thing to do, and maybe we can figure something else out in the future and do another record.
Yeah. I really want to thank all you guys too for having me, man. That was really incredible. It was really awesome and very honored to be a part of Melvin's legacy, man.
Oh yeah. And thank you for the interest. Thank you for the interest in doing this interview. I appreciate it.
Oh, always. Definitely my pleasure. And so listeners, you're in for a treat. Here's the sidelong psychic venture. Maybe comparable to Chrome's Wing Born in the Night. Maybe comparable to Sleep's Dope Smoker. Maybe comparable to a King Crimson record where there's one side per song. This is Pain Equals Funny, the massive track off the new Melvins album, Transfer Heart, and we will see you next week with Dan Bird of Chumbawamba. Buzz and Roy, thanks again.